Things were getting worse at Birkbeck. We could see it in the faces of the men when they marched by. Whenever the dentist came, which was not often these days, he told us of new horrors. In January, there was an epidemic of pneumonia. Day after day, I waited apprehensively for Abeck, grateful when I saw him, fearful and in despair when I missed him. During the long nights at my looms, the fear gnawed at me that he might become ill. A few days after the epidemic started, we heard that we were going to do laundry from the Birkbeck camp in our factory laundry. Each Monday morning, 8 girls were assigned to the laundry. Those chosen went without sleep all that day and the following night. I always volunteered for this detail, for there was a strong possibility that Abeck would be among the men who brought the clothes, and he usually was. I looked forward to those Mondays and dreaded them at the same time. I was somehow ashamed to meet Abeck. I was ashamed of my clean clothes, ashamed and pained by the kiss that he planted on my cheek when he could. And always there were the dirty, bloody, vermin-filled bundles of clothes between us. I looked for Abeck's clothes, and at the same time I hoped that I would not find them. I sought opportunities to see him and dreaded the moment that I would have to face him. I was sure now that I would marry him, although I did not want to. Yet I was comforted by the knowledge that through that long and frightful winter he never doubted my love for an instant. Day by day, night by night, the weeks passed. Toward the end of April 1944, spring showed signs of coming. Then it was upon us. The snow melted, the sky turned blue, grass and flowers seemed to come out overnight. It was as if nature wanted to compensate for that cruel long winter with one sudden, generous gesture. I was so glad for that spring, yet with its coming, Abeck's outlook seemed gloomier rather than better. Whenever I could, I wrote him cheerful notes, but he either began to sense my true feelings about him, or, like so many others, he was losing the desire to live. I begged him to pull himself together for my sake. The winter was over, the worst part of the battle over, but a shroud of resignation was closing upon him. His replies were half-hearted. On May 6th, without warning, Frau Kugler told us that we were to be transferred to a large concentration camp. We were to leave Landeshut in 2 groups on the 8th and the 9th. The news filled us with horror. In the first group to leave was Suess. As we embraced, I felt devoid of tears. We had cried too often. Ilse, Lotje, Mrs. Berger, Litzi, and I were to go into the second transport. I desperately wanted to see Abeck again, and with Frau Kugler's consent, it was arranged that Ilse and I should deliver some laundry to the Birkbeck. Acting as our official escort, Frau Kugler planned it so that we would arrive at the camp shortly before the men came back from work. Thus, on May 8th, my 20th birthday, I saw the dreaded Birkbeck for the first time. The place spelled horror to me, from the machine gun over the entrance to the tomb-like, windowless walls that housed the men. In the yard we encountered Dr. Goldstein, and I had a few words with him while Frau Kugler talked to the SS guards in charge. I begged him to look after Abeck, and he promised that he would. I saw Frau Kugler glancing at her watch. Trying to delay our departure, she suggested that she would like to see the whole camp. "You better stay right where you are," she barked at Ilse and me. As she left, she winked at us. Suddenly I knew that I couldn't face him. I feared that he might break down. I didn't want to see him. I drew a piece of paper out of my pocket, and while Ilse and the dentist stood guard, I huddled against the grim stone wall of the Birkbeck and wrote a few last words to Abeck, begging him to be strong for my sake. I gave the note to the dentist. A few minutes later, Frau Kugler and the SS men returned. There was a question in her eyes, and I realized that she intended to stall some more in order that I might see Abeck. "I would rather go now," I whispered. She She did not seem to understand. She pointed to the ground to indicate that we would stay. I shook my head. She understood. Descending the hill from the Birbeck, we heard the men coming up another road, heard the shouting of the guards, the noise of the whips. Abek was standing there in that marching column. Was it possible that news had reached him about our departure? How would he take it? For a second I hesitated. Should I beg Frau Kugler to return for just a moment under some pretext? No, I had already taken the best course. I had a glimpse of the men marching into the camp. Goodbye, Abek, I whispered. At dawn we went one by one through the narrow corridor just off our barracks to be counted and turned over to the SS. Frau Kugler stood in the corridor under the pretext of searching our meager bundles, but in reality she did not look at any of them. She stood there to speak to each of us. Her face was wet with tears. "Goodbye, Goethe," she murmured under her breath. "Don't forget me." In the courtyard, as she handed over our papers to the SS, I saw her battling with tears. She stood there grim, her voice barking as it had on that first day when we met her at Boltenhain 22 months before. She was supposed to withdraw after the SS took over, but she went to the station with us. She stood there, a solitary figure, and waved a soundless farewell. I think I have described her with justice. She was a good woman. She made the time that we spent in her charge as bearable as possible. She displayed humanity. She gave us hope that perhaps not all Germans were cruel. Chapter 10. Landeshut disappeared. The impersonal train created a welcome sense of isolation for me. Sitting in the tiny compartment, I belonged to myself. My thoughts had more freedom. My dreams became keener. It was a May morning in all its glory of dewy fresh grass and budding trees. This was a setting for love, for romance, for a young gay heart, and I was 20 years old. We were traveling in a northerly direction. The rumor was that we were going to Grünberg, about 200 kilometers from Landeshut. In the early afternoon, we reached a large city, whose name I no longer remember, where we had to change trains. They herded us onto the station platform. Porters were running to and fro, people streamed past, and the gray-green uniforms of German soldiers were everywhere. Life was going on, a war was being fought, and many people walked about in their busy, free lives. Only we were slaves. I yearned to mingle with the crowds that had homes and families. Instead, I stood next to Ilse, hugging my bundle of threadbare belongings, waiting to be shipped somewhere, the yellow star ablaze on my breast, back, and head. People stared at us curiously. A porter approached, carrying luggage and a neatly folded traveling blanket. Following him was a young girl, perhaps my age, slender, tall, in a gray suit and a fresh white blouse. She wore a white beret on her carefully groomed hair. She walked rapidly toward the compartment of her train. I watched her enter it, saw the porter put her luggage into the net over her seat, saw her give him a tip. I heard the porter's muffled, "Danke, Fräulein." The girl looked at the window as if searching for someone. With fascination, I followed her every move. An older man approached. She waved and called, "Hier bin ich, Papa." I felt a quick stabbing pain. How many years was it since I had said those magic words, since I heard anyone say, "Papa"? The man entered the compartment. As the girl turned toward him for a fleeting moment, our eyes met. I saw her picture in 1,000 fragments. I saw her snowy blouse 100-fold reflected. I saw her blurred, for now I saw her through tears. The engine of her train started to puff. The train moved. Daughter and father started toward their destination. I would never know their names, their lives, their lot. but at that moment I would willingly have exchanged my life for hers. How foolish we are. A few minutes later, we boarded our new train. In my imagination, I tried to recreate the scene I had just witnessed. I reached into an imaginary purse, looked out the window searchingly, knowing that the beret sat perfectly on my hair, but when I came to the part where I should call, "Here I am, Papa," the spell was broken. In silence, we rolled toward Grünberg. When I think of Grünberg, I grow very sad. It was cruelty set against a backdrop of beauty. The gentle vineyard-covered hills silhouetted against the sapphire sky seemed to mock us. The vast camp had been built as part of a textile mill not long before the war. The sun shone through the glass roof. The camp was modern, well-scrubbed, clean, and filled with suffering. That day in 1944, when we arrived, there were approximately 1,000 girls there. Some were bursting with health and color, others were half-starved and walked about with bent backs, decaying teeth, the pallor of death already on their faces. Those who worked outdoors looked healthy and fresh. The others seemed to be gray, moving parts of the infernal machines. Though clean, the camp was badly run. The staff, appointed by the factory authorities in the days when the plant had first become a camp, consisted of a particularly evil and stupid group of girls who feasted while the rest starved as they wove and spun. The contrast was sharp. There was no in-between. There was one SS man who guarded the entrance, one Lagerführerin, very different from Frau Kugler, and several helpers, vicious and ignorant. The SS guard and the Lagerführerin checked and double-checked us in the yard in front of the building in which we were to be housed. Finally, when they had established to their satisfaction that all were present, we were admitted to the building, which consisted of three enormous halls with concrete floors. Two of the halls contained our bunks. The third was the dining hall. It was isolated from the kitchen by a partition with a window through which the food was handed. Suss came running to embrace Ilse and me. "I have saved you bunks next to mine," she said. "I met a friend here, a girl I used to know back home. You will like her." We approached the bunks, and there stood a beautiful girl. She held out both her hands. "I am Liesel Stepper," she said in a silvery voice, and as we clasped hands, I knew we would be friends. Liesel, who was from Czechoslovakia, told us about herself. She smiled a great deal, and when she did, her round eyes, brown and soft, always lit up. She reminded me of a fairy tale princess. When she walked, her movements were so graceful that she hardly seemed to touch the ground. The conversation inevitably got around to conditions in camp, and so we learned about the horrors of Grünberg and the part of the camp that spelled disaster and death, the Spinnerei. Whoever worked there did not last very long. In the morning, we girls from Landeshut assembled in the courtyard. Again, we stood appel for a long time and were snapped to attention. When the Betriebsleiter, as the director was called here, arrived, the girls had told us about him already. I looked curiously at the man who was so feared. He was tall and slender. His face was large and pale, with a square look and hollow cheeks. His eyes were deep-set and water-blue. They seemed to have no lashes at all. He had grotesquely long arms and large hands. On his right hand he wore a large signet ring. "That must be the ring," I thought. The girls had told us how he would make a fist and beat his victim with the ring until her face or body was covered with blood. It was not long before I had to witness such a scene. Every 2 weeks we took showers. On that first morning we waited in line in the long corridor, which was dimly lit, warm and moist. We could hear the hiss of the water and the steam knocking in the pipes overhead. I looked forward to having the warm, clean water touching my body. I pressed tightly against the moist wall when I saw the Betriebsleiter coming, like a huge, soft-footed cat. The girls who saw him froze into silence, but those with their backs turned continued talking. We could not warn the girls. I saw him stand motionless like a snake eyeing his prey. Then he leapt forward, digging his fingers into a girl's face. I saw it all. I did not turn away. I was hypnotized, frozen with horror and rage. I felt that I could have killed the man and enjoyed the sight of his blood. Then he walked away swiftly without wiping his hands. After it was over, it seemed like a nightmare. There was deathly silence. The beaten girl pressed her torn face toward the wall without a sound. When I got into the shower and felt the warm water on my skin, I started to shiver. My teeth chattered. I leaned against the tiled wall of the cubicle and vomited while the water ran over me. When my stomach was empty, I carefully washed the floor. I prayed that I would never be assaulted, for I knew I would strike back, even though I would have to pay for it with life itself. But this was still our first morning in Grünbeck. We stood in the courtyard waiting to be picked for our first jobs.
Spinnerei,
the Betriebsleiter announced, and I felt a shiver go through my body. Seuss was the first one to go. A few more of the tallest and prettiest girls were chosen next. Then he pointed to me. I detached myself from my group and walked over to where Seuss and the others were standing. A dozen or more girls followed, then Ilse. Our eyes met. The worst had happened, but somehow now I was not afraid. It was always uncertainty that I feared most. We were marched to the factory. It was a model German factory. In previous years, it was said, they had brought foreign visitors to see it. The architecture, layout, and machinery were beautiful, and I had to agree. The office building in front, with its multitude of spotless windows, overlooked vast, star-shaped flower beds, and against the factory walls were hundreds of rose bushes. Along the paths were beds of tulips in full bloom. We were taken to the spinning room. There I saw the girls, living skeletons with yellowish-gray skin drawn tight over prominent cheekbones. There were gaping holes in their mouths where teeth had either been knocked out or rotted out. These girls ran to and from huge spinning machines, repairing broken threads with nimble fingers. Their tired eyes and sallow jaws seemed to belie the swiftly running feet and dexterous fingers. I was put to tending one of those monstrous machines. I thought I would never learn to operate it, to tie the knots before the machine, which moved rapidly, could smash my fingers. Wherever I looked, the threads tore. I kept running from one break to another until I reached a point of complete exhaustion. Worst of all, my throat felt dry and itchy from the dust and lint in the air. But time went fast. Before I knew it, we were marching back to camp. After another long roll call, we fell on our bunks. The next day the work went more smoothly, and in less than a week I mastered the machine. However, my throat continued to bother me, as did my ankles, which had been swollen for several days. But I preferred the spinning room to staying in camp, for one did not know what might happen from one minute to the next. About every 2 months the spinning room girls were x-rayed. Each time, a number were found to have contracted tuberculosis. They were immediately sent to Auschwitz. The spinning room had the greatest turnover of girls, and these bi-monthly examinations came to be dreaded by all of us. May passed, and June came. Thousands of roses burst open in a marvelous range of colors. In the early morning, when we marched to the factory, the dew was still on the fragrant petals. Sometimes the first rays of the sun would make the drops glitter like diamonds. Day after day I had to resist the desire to run out of line and touch those beautiful blossoms. The day we all feared most came toward the end of July. We were called to have our x-rays taken. We marched through the factory gates and out into the street. I felt a strange animation, felt color shooting to my cheeks. I remembered the girl in Sosnovitz, to whom I had given the bowl of food, the first girl whom I had met from a slave camp. I could still see the two red spots glowing on her cheeks, and I felt spots burning on mine. This must be it, I thought. This is the end. I want to live. I want to live. In the physician's office, we were told to strip to the waist. I removed the little sack from my neck with the piece of broken glass and charred wood that Arthur and I gathered from our temple the day before he left Bielitz. It might show as a dark spot on my chest. I kept the sack in my hand. "Arthur," I whispered, "be with me. I am so afraid." I shivered in the summer heat. Slowly the line crept forward. "Your name?" a female voice asked. "Goethe Weissmann?" My voice sounded high and unnatural. I heard it trail off in the dark room, and there was the sound of the pencil scratching over the paper, checking my name. As in a dream, I stepped onto a platform. From far away, I heard the doctor's voice directing me how to stand. The cold plate touching my bare breast roused a familiar sensation of horror, reminding me of the time when the SS man had pointed his gun at my chest, demanding to know where Papa was. I closed my eyes. I held my lids tightly shut. There was the clicking of a switch, then another. I waited in another line while my plate was developed. Why did it take so long? Then I heard the doctor snap. "Clear!" I saw him pointing at me. "Clear! Clear!" he said, pointing to others. We returned to camp. Ilse was sitting on the bunk, her face white. "Ilse!" I called frantically. She jumped up. "Are you all right?" she whispered hoarsely. I nodded. "And you?" She nodded, too. We embraced. We had a lease on life for another 2 months. A week later, the tubercular girls departed. There was one among them whom I had gotten to know fairly well. I went to see her before she left. We embraced. There was nothing to say. What does one say to someone who knows that in a few days she won't be alive anymore? It is often said that it is best that we cannot know the future, but this case was an exception. About 2 years later, when I was working in Munich, I was in the German Museum looking through some lists of refugees that were published there daily when I heard a gay voice call to me. "Is that Goethe?" "It's me, not my ghost," said a rosy girl in a blue sweater. As she came closer, I remembered our sad farewell in Grünberg before she had left for Auschwitz. As she embraced me, we both started to cry. Then she told me what had happened. When her group reached Auschwitz, they were taken to the death house, but traffic was heavy there. Things were so busy they had to wait for death. As she sat on the ground, she idly dug into the soil of which she was soon to become a part. The gesture was her salvation, for she unearthed a handful of gems. To what forgotten soul had they belonged? The girl was momentarily dazed. Then she ran up to an SS guard. What had she to lose? "Help me," she pleaded, and gave him the bundle. "I want to live." Somehow he got her and two other girls from her group places to work in the kitchen. That parcel of gems saved three lives, even though the guard could have taken the gift and refused to help the girls. When she finished her story, I asked the girl about her lungs. She smiled. "That is another strange story. I went to a number of doctors, but they found nothing wrong. Perhaps that is another miracle, or perhaps the doctor in Grünberg made a mistake." Whatever the explanation was, the girl had been given back her life. As the hot summer wore on, conditions in Grünberg became worse. Working hours grew longer, there was less food, the transports to Auschwitz were more frequent. For a time I worked on the night shift. Here I became friendly with Liesel Stepper. We talked many hours in the daytime when we should have slept. She told me she was in love with a boy from Vienna, and though she had not heard from him in years, she thought of him constantly. She was relatively free of bitterness. Together we dreamed of the wonderful life we should have when the war would be over. One day a heavy summer rain fell, thunder and lightning tore the sky. I woke and saw Liesl lying motionless on her bunk, her eyes wide open. I called her. She turned slowly toward me. "I will put on the red raincoat," she said. "No, the blue one is better for today. I will go out into the garden. The grass will be wet. I will pick up the apples that the storm blew down. It tastes wonderful, that cold, wet apple. But I better hurry. I have an appointment later." "With the dressmaker," I interrupted, falling in with her mood. We played the game to perfection. One morning in September, I was returning to camp from the factory, looking forward to some sleep. My head constantly felt heavy and dull. My legs hurt from running all night after the devilish spinning machine. Suddenly, when our guard had his head turned, a piece of bread was thrown over the fence into the courtyard. The girl ahead of me quickly picked up the bread, and as she did, I heard her faint, terror-stricken voice whisper, "Don't give me away." The SS man saw the incident. He demanded to know who threw the bread. We knew there would be a penalty, head-shaving, beating, or worse. One by one we were questioned. "I don't know," was each answer. Then the husky SS guard with his heavy arm would hit the tired face again and again. I was frightened. I would rather have gone without food or worked 24 hours straight through than bear physical punishment. But my turn came, and I muttered an exhausted, "I don't know." I felt a heavy blow over my eyes. "Who?" he demanded. "I don't know," I repeated. Another blow fell, deafening my left ear. I swayed and staggered toward the building. When I finally reached my bunk, I sat there without undressing. My face was puffed and bruised. My skin and lips were moist with blood. I must have cried without knowing it. 30 girls were beaten that morning. I don't know what the blows did to the others, but they shattered the wall of strength that I had built for myself. Neither propaganda talks, designed to break our morale, nor hunger, nor work, no matter how hard, had affected my resistance, as had the brutal blows of that guard. "If only they don't touch my flesh, I can survive," I thought. Survive? All of a sudden it did not seem worthwhile. All the suffering and agony for what? How could we be free when they would kill us first? How much longer would it last? It was now September 1944, 5 years since the Germans had taken Bielitz, and there was still no end in sight. How long could we go on? When would it be my turn to go to Auschwitz? How many more X-ray examinations would pass before I would be doomed? Ilse, who worked on the day shift, came back at noon. She walked quietly past my bunk, thinking I was asleep. I called her. When she turned around, she was smiling. I hid my bruised face under the blanket. She turned away from me so that I could not see what she was doing and dug into her pocket. "I brought you a present," she announced triumphantly. There on a fresh leaf was one red, slightly mashed raspberry. As I sat up, she stared at my face. The raspberry rolled under the bunk. I crawled under to get it. I ate it slowly, dust and all. Its sweet juice mingled with the saltiness on my lips. A few days later, fortune smiled at me. The incredible happened. Suze Kuntz and I were chosen for different work. There was an old German in the spinning room who weighed the finished crates of yarn, recorded the weights in a ledger, and put each crate on a conveyor belt which carried it to storage. One day we noticed that the crates remained piled up at the end of the row of machines. The man who kept the production records had not come. The Obermeister, or head foreman, went from machine to machine several times that day. In the afternoon he called Seuss and me and asked whether we could write. We both said we could. "Now," he said, shaking a bony finger, That requires thinking. I don't know if you would be able to do it. I wondered if he wanted to hurt us, or if he really thought that we were some type of animal. He showed us the ledger columns in which each machine was listed by number, with spaces to note the weight of material each machine produced. Then he made us enter a few figures. Lightly, he cautioned, so we can erase it in case of error. Think, he repeated. Think! With serious faces, we both thought. We almost burst into laughter. We passed the tests well and were told that one of us would work days the other nights. The foreman then took us to his office and gave us each a folded piece of paper. Give them to the Lagerführerin, he said. Out of sight, we looked at the messages. We had been given hard labor cards, entitling each of us to an extra bowl of food daily. An extra bowl! We were rich. That meant that Ilse and I would not be hungry anymore, and it meant the same for Seuss and Liesel. The work was very hard. We had to lift the heavy crates and carefully place them on the running belt. A crooked crate might tangle with the yarn or cause congestion, and this would have meant sabotage. But I liked the work. I was not confined to one machine. Instead, I went all over the vast halls. Other workers envied me and stared when they saw me walking around with the ledger. It was interesting to walk through the spinning halls. Huge machines tore the raw materials to shreds. These shreds were beaten into a loose, cotton-like substance that a carding machine then combed into loose strips that could be spun. Each spinning hall had its own carding machine. During the long hours of the autumn nights, while the machines hummed busily and the sleepwalking skeletons ran after the threads, I walked through the plant, weighing the heavy crates, entering the amounts of yarn that helped Germany's economy, helped Germany fight us. Deliveries of old clothes arrived daily from Auschwitz to be shredded up and converted into yarn. A number of the girls who ran the shredding machines insisted that they had recognized their parents' clothes. We had heard that in Auschwitz prisoners were told to undress for showers, that they were then handed bread rations and sent into the showers. Only when the vents opened it was not water, but gas. Once I passed the shredder, I thought I saw Mama's coat. I turned away, praying, then forced myself to look again. It was just a black coat. It could have been anybody's. Hundreds of people wore black coats. And as always, when in despair, I started to think of my homecoming. I placed and replaced details upon details, playing with the fragments of my dreams. Who would come home first? I always wished that I should come last, walk into the house to find them all there. At times I thought I would reach home late at night. The house would be dark. I would not wake them. I would go to the garden and wait. I would watch the sunrise. Then I would approach the house. Mama would be wearing her flowered house coat. No, she wouldn't. We had given it away for a pound of margarine and a loaf of bread. Well, anyway, breakfast would be on the table. Arthur wouldn't be there, and Mama would say to me, "Go wake Arthur. You know he never gets down in time." I would run up the stairs. My brother's hair would be tousled, as it always was in the morning. "Arthur," I would whisper. He would mutter something and turn over and pretend to go back to sleep. Then, realizing I had come back, he would sit up with his wide-open eyes, stretching out his arms. It would be as it had always been from the time when I had brought him my book of fairy tales to read. He had read them to me for years before I learned to read. And we would come downstairs together, holding hands, as we had done when we were small, so I should not stumble. We would come down, and Papa and Mama would be holding hands, too. We would approach Papa for benediction, as we had done as children. We both would have to bow, for we had gotten so tall, and Papa would kiss the Bible, even as his father had before him when he returned from Siberia, and Papa would speak the words of Jacob, "I had not thought to see your face again, but God." The night wore on. The horizon became lighter. Another day was coming to Grünberg. The machines seemed to go faster. The shredder rolled louder, tearing to bits the clothes from Auschwitz. and I held in my heart the picture of my homecoming. Chapter 11. On the last day of November, we didn't march to work. I was now on the day shift, and after the morning roll call, for which we usually assembled shortly before 5 a.m., we were kept standing in the cold courtyard for several hours. Finally, two open trucks drove through the gates, halted, and 30 or 40 young women in smart, trim SS uniforms dismounted and waited in the outer yard. Then came a staff car. A few high-ranking officers got out and went into the building that housed us. Our names were called in alphabetical groups. Those who were called went in but did not come out again. Panic mounted. We could not imagine what was going on inside, and of course we assumed the worst. The morning wore on. Around noon, Ilse's name, Kleinsoller, was called. She embraced me, her eyes filled with tears. "Stop it, Ilse," I snapped. "Stop it or I will go crazy. Nothing will happen." But I was not at all sure. Inwardly, I was afraid, and when Ilse was gone, I nearly gave way. The thought that something was happening to Ilse and not to me at the same time drove me into a frenzy. The hours until I was called in the late afternoon seemed endless. I was among the last 25 girls. We were told to undress completely. I was rebellious and furious, but we all did as we were told. We were then marched into the dining hall. I clenched my fists and stood erect. The army officers and the SS women were seated at a long table. In the center of a floor was a circle drawn with chalk. I felt as if we were stepping on hot coals as I stepped into the circle. My body burned. I closed my eyes to blot out their staring. I was given a number, 895A, and told to dress and go to my bunk. When I got there, I was relieved to see Ilse. No one was yet sure of the meaning of the examination. The officers departed and the SS women took charge of the camp. They were everywhere and watched us every moment. In time, rumors began to circulate. It was said that there were many, many sick and wounded soldiers who needed the amusement that pretty and healthy girls could provide. "Never," I vowed. "Rather tuberculosis and Auschwitz than that." The situation led to my discovering that one of the girls from Sosnowiec had some poison and that she was willing to sell some of it for a price. I wanted that poison. I had no money, but I still had the diamond and pearl pendant Mama had sewn into the padding of my coat. With Ilse on the lookout for intruders, I went to my bunk and carefully removed the pendant from my coat. I kissed it quickly, remembering how well it had looked on Mama's throat. Then I went in search of the girl with the poison. After some haggling, I surrendered the pendant for two tiny white flat packets. One I gave to Ilse. We folded them in cotton padding and inserted them in our shoe linings. My ski boot felt uncomfortable at first, but after a short time I was hardly aware of the packet. 2 weeks passed and nothing happened. Nobody was called or sent away, and we were not taken to be X-rayed. Nothing much changed except that we were now awakened at 4 a.m. instead of 5 and made to stand at a long appel in the courtyard before going to work. The SS women counted us over and over. Each morning the process became more and more drawn out until they started to wake us half an hour earlier. It was bitterly cold during those morning hours. One morning in December there was snow on the ground when we awoke. Winter was here again. A few days later, there were several air raid alarms. They were the first we experienced. The German workers ran for shelter while we stayed in the factory with the current turned off and the machines idle. We tried hard not to look too pleased. Then we were told that we must go to the shelter when the alarm sounded. Apparently, nobody wanted to risk his skin watching us. The sirens began to howl more and more frequently. The Germans threw frightened glances toward the sky and hatefully looked at us. "Let them worry now," we gloated. "Let them sit on the charred remains of their homes. Let them see their families killed. Then will they shout, Heil Hitler? It's coming, whispered my heart. Their downfall is coming. But I was not naive. I knew that it would not come without increased suffering on our part. Christmas passed. There was no Christmas spirit that year. The new year came, the year of 1945. In January, the sirens blew almost daily. Less and less production was entered into the books. At noon one day, the electricity went off. The supervisors stood talking excitedly. The SS women took us back to camp. Something drastic had happened. Perhaps the war was over. That night we were ordered to take all of our belongings and go into the dining hall. The door to our sleeping quarters was barricaded. After being given food, we huddled together, waiting. It was snowing heavily. After a time, we heard the courtyard gates burst open. Every heart beat faster in expectation. There were shrieks and screams and cries outside. We could hear running feet and shouting from the other side of the barricaded doors. Those of us who sat next to the doors started calling to the newcomers in our sleeping quarters. They were Jewish girls. They had come from another camp and had been walking for 5 days. Now we were to join them. They thought we were going to Oranienburg, a concentration camp like Auschwitz, to be gassed. Auschwitz, they said, had been captured by the Russians, who had reconquered Poland and were crossing the German frontier. The English and Americans were invading Germany from the west. Would a miracle happen before we reached the gas chambers? And so the last stretch of the war began. Not in peaceful Bolkenhain, not in the coal cars of Marsdorf, the night shifts of Landeshut. Nor were we to endure it in tuberculosis-ridden Grünberg. I was certain that we would meet freedom somewhere in the open, and that we would meet it soon. You are crazy, Seuss said. We will never see the liberation, for they will see to it. They would leave us here if they did not want us killed. We will be free, I insisted. I know it. I feel it. Ilse and Liesel sat in silence, Sue's big eyes filled with tears, the first tears that I ever saw her shed. How can you believe so strongly? She murmured. But then you always believed. Remember when we met on the train? I nodded. Well, you lost that bet, she reminded me. I know, I said. But you still believe? I do. Tell me, Goethe, Seuss whispered urgently. What is it? What makes you so sure? I don't know. It's something I cannot explain, but I know somehow that we will be liberated. And I feel, Seuss stammered, I feel that I will not be. All that last night in Grünberg I coughed. I think I had a temperature. Ilse, Seuss, Liesel, and I cuddled together closely. Goethe, don't get sick, they begged, as if I could decide. At dawn we were given 3 portions of bread, which we carefully placed in our bundles. We saw the kitchen personnel pack big parcels of food in their bundles. At the last moment before we assembled, the 4 of us decided to put on most of the clothes we had intended to carry. The SS women came for us. We lined up. Ilse was on my left, Liesel and Seuss were on my right. We stood erect. Let us be strong, Liesel whispered. Yes, I answered. You be strong, Ilse whispered back to me. I was now the least fit of the group. As we squeezed through the door, we gripped hands for a fleeting moment. Then we marched out into the bright snow. The outer gates were open when we reached the courtyard. Stretching as far as we could see were columns of girls. I was shocked to see so many. We learned later there were about 3,000 from other camps. With our contingent from Grünberg, we totaled nearly 4,000. We were divided into two transports amidst much whipping and screaming by the SS. Many girls tried to shift from one group to another in the hope that it might be the better one. We four were in the column which was doomed. Out of 2,000, only 120 survived. The other column was liberated much sooner. Had I been part of it, my fate would have been different. Less suffering, yes, but less happiness, too, I'm sure. Although I had seen misery, I was utterly unprepared for the picture that the girls who had already been marching for a week presented. Covered with gray blankets, they reminded me of drawings of death, when, winged and garbed in loose sheets, he comes to collect the living. Some of them were barefoot, others wore crude wooden logs. Many of them left a bloody trail in the fresh snow. Seuss looked at me, and I looked at my feet, clad in the ski boots that Papa had insisted I wear on that hot summer day. Papa, Papa, how could he possibly have known? The boots were still in good shape, and I had precious things hidden in them, snapshots of Papa, Mama, Arthur, and Abeck, wrapped in a piece of cloth, and the packet of poison. In Grünberg they had taken away all the pictures, papers, and letters. Germany, we were told, needed all scrap paper she could get. Ilse and I had managed to hide our pictures. Our only worry now was that water might soak through our shoes and ruin them. "Forward march!" shouted the SS Wachmeister at the head of our column. "Forward march!" echoed the SS men. Carrying rifles, they were stationed along our column at intervals of about 30 feet. "Forward march!" came the high-pitched voices of the whip-armed SS women. We took the first step. I thought, I am marching to death or to liberation. It was the morning of January 29th, 1945. We marched all day with a break at noon. Ilse and I shared one of our portions of bread, guarding the rest carefully. At the head of the column we saw the commandant of the SS with a Hungarian Jewish girl who, we were told, was his mistress. She and a few of her close friends knew no want. They had plenty to eat and slept always in peasant houses rather than in barns or in open fields as the others did. How could they? I asked myself over and over again. Toward evening, as it grew colder, we were herded off the road and into a huge barn. We huddled together in the darkness, and again Ilse and I shared a portion of our bread. It wasn't enough. "Ilse, I'm terribly hungry," I confessed. "So am I," Ilse admitted. "I would like something warm to drink. We can't eat any more bread, for who knows when they will give us more." "Careful, careful," somebody called in the darkness. "The Magyars are after our bread." Yes, the poor Hungarian girls were hungry. They had been marching a week already. "My shoes, my shoes," another voice cried. "They took them from right next to me." Many of the Hungarian girls had no shoes. To save their lives, they stole shoes off the feet of those who slept. How much I learned that night. When the doors of the dark barn were thrown open in the morning, I could see a flood of wintry sunlight on the glittering snow. Two SS men stood at the entrance and with their rifles prodded us as we emerged four abreast. A little distance away stood the SS commandant with his girlfriend and her court of privileged friends. They were eating bread and drinking something steaming out of a large thermos. How good it must feel, I thought, the warm drink in that cold. We assembled and were counted and recounted. A girl from Grünberg was missing. A few others were beaten bloody because of it, but either they did not know what had become of her or they would not tell. We learned the story later. A German from the factory who was in love with the girl had followed our column and under cover of darkness had snatched her quietly away. We marched many miles that second day, often plowing through untouched snow. Again we rested at midday. "I wonder when they will give us something to eat," Ilse said to the three of us as we nibbled our dry, frozen bread. We did not answer. Girls who had lagged behind that morning had been beaten by the SS men with the butts of their guns.
After the midday pause, a couple of girls just sat motionless on the snow, refusing to go. We marched on. Behind us, there were pistol shots. "God," I said. "God," looking up to the sky. The sky was blue, the snow was clean, the snowy pine trees were beautiful in the sunlight. Chapter 12. Yet another day we marched on in a westward direction. It was the last day that we had bread. We were no longer counted. They could not keep track of how many were shot or died during the night. I was cold and hungry, but for the time being I minded the cold more. At night I felt Ilse's hand in mine. I took off my shoes and curled myself over them for fear that someone might steal them. There was muffled crying all around me. I did not cry, but there in those barns I stopped praying. Through all the years I had prayed to God ardently and with hope. Now I prayed no more. I did not consciously know why, for I was closer to my Maker than ever. One short shot away. I wanted to be at peace with God, but I could not pray. But later, much later, I thought about my way of praying. It started in school with a play about ancient Egypt. Each character uttered a prayer. The mighty Pharaoh prayed for a victory. His opponent asked for his own success. A sick man begged for health. The doctor asked for people to be ill. And each prayer, clean and swift, like a white bird, shot upward. In heaven it met with the other prayer that had asked for just the contrary. They turned against each other in bloody battle, and usually both fell back lifeless to the earth. A large number of girls had taken part in that play. I thought I had a beautiful role. I was a poor little boy, the son of a fella. My mother told me to pray, but I didn't know how. I had no wishes, so I just looked at the river that fertilized our field, at the warm sun, at the ripe fruit in our garden, and I said, "Thank you, God, for the warm sun, for the blue Nile, for my father and my mother." And my little boy's prayer, like the others, sailed straight up to the throne of God. Nobody defied my prayer, and nobody else thanked the Maker. They were all asking him for things. He turned his face upon the little barefoot boy. I was about 12 years old at the time. From then on, I had always thanked God for the gifts he bestowed upon me, and there were many. There had always been something to be grateful for, even after 1939, but during that cold March, when we rested in the icy barns, hungry, afraid, I could pray no more. On the fourth day of our march, we heard artillery fire. It was rumored that the Russians were moving forward rapidly. Once, I think, we were almost overrun by them. We heard two SS men discussing the destruction of the railroad, and thus we learned that we were to have been shipped by rail to the death camp. Now we would have to go all that way on foot. On the fifth morning, a number of SS women were missing. Apparently, they had no mind to march on. Perhaps they wanted to return to their homes. The war was coming to an end, we thought, but so was our strength. We had now gone 4 days without food. It was over a week since we had left Grünberg. It was an icy day. A sharp wind bit at our faces. We marched longer than usual before the midday break, and when we took it, we were anxious to get moving again. That afternoon, as we were marching through a thicket, we heard shots. A moment later, one of the SS men pointed a gun at me. "Come along," he shouted. I stepped out of line. The SS pulled out 3 more girls. I heard the column marching on. I no longer felt the snow whip my face. I felt no rebellion, no wild pounding of my heart. I just felt at peace. Oddly enough, I thought of a winter's day at home, and Schmutzi, my cat, bringing her newborn kittens into the kitchen to warm them by the stove. I tried desperately to remember what we had named the kittens, but I couldn't. After a few steps, I had been daydreaming for only a moment. We came to a clearing. There were 2 bodies in the snow. "Take them to the woods," the SS man commanded. My arms felt unequal to it. "Take her head," snapped the girl nearest me. I looked at the dead girl's face. I did not know her. Her eyes were open, I lifted her head. The snow beneath was red. The two of us were too weak to lift her, so we took her by the arms and dragged her into the trees. When we left her, she looked alive. I scooped up snow to wash her blood off my hands. We did not see the other girls. The SS man stood smoking a cigarette. I thought our turn was next, but he made us hurry to join the column. Ilse looked relieved when I returned. We held hands silently. I was in a state of shock. We walked for a long, long time that evening, passing through tiny villages. Here and there a light showed. Smoke came from chimneys. We could see women preparing supper. How snug and warm everybody looked. We entered another town. It was dark now. Nobody was in the streets. The wind was howling as we were led to a low hill where a church stood. The SS women and the favorites were lodged in town. The three SS guards who accompanied us told us to lie on the frozen earth in the front of the church. The wind swept the snow over us. After a few minutes we were covered. Ilse and I cuddled close, trying with our bodies to warm each other. Towering over us, the church stood silent, not even with its bell ringing the hours of our misery. The bells had probably been melted to make bullets. "I'm so cold," Ilse chattered. We pressed our cold cheeks together. The snow did not even melt on our faces. I thought of the girl I had dragged into the forest. By now the snow had given her its decent burial. "Ilse," I said. She didn't seem to hear me. I remembered a lamp burning softly under the yellow shade in my nursery, Nyanya reading me the story of the little match girl. I could hear Nyanya's warm tones, and the little match girl smiled. She did not feel the cold any more. "Ilse," I shook her. "Leave me alone," she protested. "Ilse," I shouted, "wake up, you're not going to sleep." She was awake now. I rubbed her face, her stiff hands. I called to Suze and Liesel. They responded. We passed the word around not to sleep. The SS men were stamping and blowing on their hands. Here and there a girl stood up. "Lie down," the SS men would shout. We did everything we could think of to keep each other awake and encouraged. Finally dawn broke and the wind stopped. In the gray morning light we could see the miserable faces, the deep, hungry eyes. Those of us who had the strength brushed the drifts from silent mounds. There were a number of little match girls. "How foolish we are," Seuss exclaimed. "We should have all gone to sleep." The frost broke. The air felt warmer. We were thirsty and started to eat snow. Late that afternoon we came to Camp Christianstadt. We waited before its gates a long time. Then we were admitted, put into the huge room, and given something warm to eat. I don't know what it was, but no meal was ever more welcome. We dried our clothes, and most of us in the warm room began to itch. The lice had already started on us. The taste of food in the warm camp made most of us optimistic again. We did not have to stand roll call. They just left us as we were, gave us something to eat twice a day, and we were happy. We knew the war was almost over. When we had been in Christianstadt 3 days, we heard that we were to move again. Ilse was beside herself. I had never seen her like that. Before, I had had the power to make her moods change. Her belief in me was so strong that it embarrassed me at times, but I failed to help her now. We marched west again, and that first evening the streets and roads were full of people, all moving in the same direction. They were fleeing before the Russian advance, horses and buggies, children in their parents' arms. We could hear the steady firing of artillery behind us. I was elated. "It is coming. This is the end. The circle is drawing to a close. The Germans are beginning to pay the penalty for their crimes." The sight of refugees fired my imagination with new hope. That first night after we left Christianstadt, we slept in another barn. A few more girls did not rise with us in the morning. The next day we saw more refugees. From their speech, we knew that they were from Silesia. We began toying with the idea of escape. Several girls had already slipped away under cover of darkness when we marched at night. From various sources, we learned that some survived and were taken in by peasants, but that others were found and shot.